you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your Friday's off to a very strong start. Film Week is coming up in less than an hour. We've got a bunch of movies to talk about, and then it's a bonus hour of Air Talk. We're going to have that for you coming up at 11 o'clock today. But we begin with the news, I think to the surprise of many of us, first delivered by former President Trump on his platform Truth Social, in which he said he was going to be indicted by federal authorities and that he would be making an appearance at court Tuesday in Miami. We now have word that the judge who has at least initially assigned this case is one who was appointed by the former president, and that judge faced criticism over her decision to grant the former president's request for an independent arbiter to review the documents that had been obtained during an FBI search of his Florida estate. Now, that decision by the judge was later overturned on appeal. The appellate judges found that the judge had overstepped her authority in ordering that. But she initially, Judge Aileen Cannon, has the initial jurisdiction over the case. Joining us to talk about the charges involved is Lori Levinson, Loyola Law School, professor of criminal law, herself a former federal prosecutor. Professor Levinson, always a pleasure. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry.
Were you surprised that the former president was the one to make the public announcement, not federal authorities?
Yeah, it's certainly unusual, but everything touching former President Trump seems to be handled in a different way. It wasn't a surprise to him. It wasn't a surprise to his team. They had come in and tried to convince Jack Smith, special counsel, not to bring this indictment, but he went forward with the grand jury.
So the Justice Department is expected sometime, perhaps later today, to formally make the announcement of the charges. But multiple people close to the investigation have said there are seven criminal charges that are alleged. To you, which is the most significant of these?
Well, interestingly, they all revolve around the classified documents that Trump held on to. And so he's facing charges, felony charges, regarding the mishandling of those documents. But the more serious charges may be the obstruction charges that we're hearing about, that he lied and did other things to cover up what he was doing with the classified documents. There could be other charges as well that hook him with the actions of others, whether it be conspiracy or accomplice liability. But I think many people are focusing on the obstruction.
Well, and what's the adage that federal authorities will typically get you on tax evasion or perjury? So is this a case where that may be the easiest of these things to prove, that he was deceptive and flat out lied about the documents that he was holding?
That's right. I mean, the cover-up is often much worse than the initial crime. People have been asking, how is this different from what Mike Pence did or even President Biden? And this is the part that's different. To the extent that President Trump lied or had people conceal documents or lie for him or have documents destroyed, that puts it in a different category.
I had seen on the Associated Press that apparently a couple of former Trump attorneys had testified before the grand jury. There is attorney-client privilege, so how does something like that happen?
I think that privilege was waived through the crime fraud exception. In other words, if a client, here Trump, approaches a lawyer to help him commit a fraud or a crime, then that's no longer privilege, and those lawyers can come in and testify. And don't forget, in this case, there was an affidavit signed by a lawyer under the penalty of perjury that all the documents had been disclosed, and that turned out not to be true. So for that lawyer, she and others definitely need to have the ability to explain what happened in the chain of information.
And if they make the argument they were misled by the former president or members of his team, is that a strong defense on their part or not?
Well, we don't know, frankly, if anyone else is going to be charged in this indictment. All they cared about was whether they had permission in the grand jury to answer the questions. So I suspect that the crime fraud exception was at play, and that was worked out during the investigation. There might be other lawyers who, frankly, haven't testified. We know there's a great deal of movement right now in his lawyers. He's let a couple lawyers go. Jim Trustee is the main lawyer. He's a former federal prosecutor, and he's bringing in other former federal prosecutors to help with the defense.
And we have a couple of resignations, I believe, of members of his legal team this morning. And what would be the reasons behind that?
Well, what we've been hearing is that the president just didn't listen to his lawyers, and they did not have open and honest communication with him. Another reason for that is that he may have been surrounded up to this point with lawyers who are more like consultants. But at this point, facing an actual criminal charge, he needs the lawyers who can go into court, file the motions, and try the case.
We're talking with Loyola Law Professor Lori Levinson. The former president had claimed that he had declassified documents that he was taken, that he was entitled to do so. We talked about this months ago when this first came up and the raid was conducted on Mar-a-Lago. But what would the president's former president's legal team have to prove to make that a viable argument?
Well, that's going to be a challenging argument for them now, because we now know that there's a tape that came out where President Trump has a conversation about documents and said, I could have declassified them while I was president, but it's too late now. If that's accurate, then it's going to be hard for him to say, gee, they were still under my control and my discretion to handle. But I think we're going to see every defense. I think we're going to see the defense that the Classified Document Act doesn't really work in this way, that the president didn't have the intent to deceive anyone, that when the president said certain things, it was being said out of context, that the prosecution overreached. They're going to bring every defense they can.
Lori, what about the venue for a potential trial? Would this be held in Miami because of Mar-a-Lago being in the state of Florida? Would it be in D.C.? What's the likely venue?
The likely venue is in Florida. I think the government expected that. That's where their grand jury was. That's where the indictment came out of. The bigger concern is the judge on this matter. As you mentioned, Elaine Cannon, who is not only a Trump appointee, who made a very serious, erroneous ruling earlier. So I don't know if the government has any grounds for seeking to recuse her. But from the government's perspective, everyone's being said, Florida is Trump town. On the other hand, let's not forget, it was a Florida grand jury that actually indicted him. So they're going to have to be careful in jury selection, but we don't know yet who's actually going to be deciding this case.
Well, and does, in a sense, it advantage the federal government, because if they were to secure a conviction in Florida, it would diminish to some extent the argument that it was a partisan jury that would have convicted him?
That's right. I mean, I think the government has to play this case the way they do any case, which is ordinarily venue is where the offense occurred, and that is Mar-a-Lago.
Thank you so much, Professor Levinson, as always. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Lori. Thank you.
Thank you. Lori Levinson, professor of criminal law at Loyola Law School here in Los Angeles, and herself a former federal prosecutor. You're, of course, going to be hearing continuing coverage right here on LAist 89.3 coming up this afternoon with the first hour of NPR's All Things Considered at 1 o'clock with Austin Cross. Austin, of course, will be on top of any updates that come during his special live hour, where he's conducting interviews and taking listener calls between 2 and 3 o'clock, and of course, with All Things Considered, the afternoon drive time with Nick Roman right here on LAist 89.3. So this is the place to stay for that continuing coverage. Again, we're awaiting the formal word from the Justice Department, in which they are expected to detail all of the indictments and the charges that are alleged here. Also, just want to remind you that Film Week is coming up at 10 o'clock, right after this hour of Air Talk. And our critics this week are Amy Nicholson, Manuel Betancourt, and Charles Solomon. They'll tell us about the 7th Transformer film in the series, Transformers Rise of the Beasts, starring Anthony Ramos and Dominique Fishback. Also, Flamin' Hot, which is Eva Longoria's directorial debut for a feature film. It tells the story of Richard Montañez, who worked for Frito-Lay, actually started out as a janitor at the company, and he was the one, according to his account, who really brought them the idea of Flamin' Hot Cheetos, which of course became a food sensation. So Jesse Garcia stars in Flamin' Hot. We'll hear what our critics think about that coming up at 10 o'clock right here on Film Week on LAist 89.3.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Train from Poncho Sanchez's 2019 album Train's Delight, a tribute to the great John Coltrane. Yet another example of the versatility of the great conguero and Latin jazz band leader Poncho Sanchez's recordings, which combine soul music with classic straight-ahead jazz, pay tribute to some of the masters of the genre. And Poncho Sanchez will be on stage coming up Saturday of next weekend, June 17th, at the Hollywood Bowl Jazz Festival, the festival being held the afternoon and evenings of next weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the 17th and 18th. Poncho, it's great to have you back with us again on Air Talk. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Larry. Thank you so much. It's an honor and pleasure to be back with you. And I see you're doing great, man. I was hearing you a little while ago, and, man, you're just... You're still knocking them out. You're doing great, Larry.
Hey, thank you. I still have the little bongo that you gave my son Desmond. He's by the way, turns 22 this week, and he was a little boy when you gave him that. So thanks very much. Lots happened. So let me ask you about playing, first of all, the Hollywood Bowl, which you've done a number of times, but you've traveled the world playing at jazz festivals at the greatest outdoor venues and greatest indoor venues that can be found. What's it like for you as someone who grew up here in Los Angeles playing at the Bowl?
Well, Larry, you know, it's always an honor and a pleasure to play at the Bowl because, first of all, as you mentioned, I grew up here around here. I mean, I'm from Laredo, Texas, but I grew up in Southern California. So all the folks that have grown up in Southern California know how beautiful and how great the sound is at the Hollywood Bowl. And that's just the audience, you know, and so it's always fun and exciting to go to the Bowl to take in a concert. And for us, the performers, it's equally as well because they got a great sound system, even for us, our monitors, and they got a great crew that takes good care of us, and we do our sound checks earlier in the day and all that stuff. So it makes for a long day, but it's an exciting day, you know. And you're right, we've done it about, I don't know, I played at the Bowl maybe about 6-7 times, something like that. So we've been part of the Jazz Fest there for many years, going all the way back to Darling Chan and the Playboy. So, and now, of course, it's the Hollywood Bowl Jazz Fest.
But a great history of the Jazz Festival at the Bowl. I think I might have seen you five of the six times over the years. Now, coming up next Saturday, the 17th, the lineup, in addition to Poncho Sanchez, includes Samara Joy. If you have not heard her, she was the Grammy winner this year for Best New Artist. I've had the pleasure of seeing her. She was just out at the Soraya at Cal State Northridge a couple of months ago. An incredible young voice. What is she like, 20 years old or something? I mean, just very young woman and extraordinary. Have you heard her, Poncho?
No, I have not, but luckily I'll be able to hear her that day because we'll be there early. And
Don't miss her.
The whole day.
Yeah, she's great. And, of course, the great saxophonist and band leader himself, Kamasi Washington, who is the co-artistic director with Herbie Hancock of the festival, St. Paul and the Broken Bones with that great brass sound, and the Los Angeles County High School of the Arts Jazz Ensemble will be starting things off, followed by the Herbie Hancock Institute of Jazz Performance Ensemble that's headquartered at UCLA. Starts at 3:30 Saturday, June 17th, goes until into the night, 10:30 or 11 o'clock. And then Sunday, another great lineup I'll tell you about momentarily. But Poncho, let me ask you about Afro-Cuban jazz and all the fusion of music that this encompasses. What is it that so appeals to you about all these varieties of music and the creative ways of incorporating it into Afro-Cuban jazz?
Well, you know, Larry, for me, I mentioned I grew up here in Los Angeles, so I was exposed to a lot of different types of music. And Latin jazz, I'm very proud to say that it was born here in the United States of America when the great Dizzy Gillespie met Chano Pozo, the great Cuban conga drummer, in the late 40s. When they met, they created this thing that we call nowadays Latin jazz. Of course, many years ago, they would call it Afro-Cuban jazz, but now they call it Latin jazz. And also, the great thing about Latin jazz, you take all the different types of music like jazz. You can take jazz melodies, jazz harmonies, and mix it with what they call salsa music nowadays, the mambo, the cha-cha-cha, the merengue, the cumbia. You can put all those elements into to create Latin jazz. And also, we like to play Latin soul music.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
That brings in soul music like James Brown, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, the Motown sound. You can take some of the soul tunes, like I have a record called Out of Sight, and that's
I
a
love
tune
that album.
Recorded many, many years ago, but I did a Latin cha-cha-cha, a funky cha-cha-cha version of James Brown's Out of Sight, along with other soul numbers like that. So we love it because we can mix soul music, jazz, and salsa music all in one.
We're talking with Poncho Sanchez, Grammy Award-winning Latin jazz band leader, conguero. He sings as well on his recordings, and they won the Grammy in 2000 for Best Latin Jazz Album for Latin Soul, the Concord Picante album release of that year. Is the Coltrane one your latest you've got out?
Yes, that's the latest, and also that one got nominated for a Grammy about 2 years ago. In the middle of the pandemic, I did the Grammys from my music room here at home.
That's great. Well, it seems like your albums are almost automatically nominated for Grammys.
Larry, we're proud to say we've been nominated 10 times for 10 different records, and we won twice. I also got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the NERIS, the Latin Grammys.
Yeah, yes, well-deserved for all your years. Starting out with Cal Jader, the great vibraphonist group, and for you as a young man starting out in that group, what you know, so much of jazz is what's passed down generationally. What's the most important thing that you learned touring from a group like that?
Well, I learned a great deal, Larry, from the late, great Cal Jader. And, you know, before I was in his band, of course, he had great, great conga drummers in his band like Mongo Santa Maria, Armando Peraza, Willie Bobo, was the timbal player in Cal Jitters band also at one time. And that was in the early 60s. And, of course, my older brothers and sisters bought the Cal Jitter records. And that's how I got turned on to the early Cal Jitter music. And so I studied his music when I was in junior high school and in high school. And then I was lucky enough to land the gig with Cal Jitter. And 1975, on New Year's Eve, I started with Cal Jitter at the Coconut Grove, opposite of Carmen McRae's band.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, so that was a big deal for me. And that was in 1975, and I spent 7.5 years with Cal Jitter on the road. I did about a dozen records with him. We won the Grammy in 1980, and we were nominated the following year in 81 for the Gozame Pero Ya record. So I learned a great deal just by being around Cal and learning, because I was the youngest guy in the band. I was 24, 25 years old,
mm-hmm.
and the other guys were all like in their 40s and 50s. So
yeah.
I learned a great deal just by hanging around the guys in the daytime and, you know, traveling to Seattle, going to Texas and whatnot, wherever we performed, and you learn a lot just by hanging around.
Yeah.
But one thing I definitely learned from Cal Jitter is that he had a knack for taking jazz standards and making them into Latin jazz standards as a mambo or a cha-cha-cha. So some of the even American standards will lend themselves, the melodies will lend themselves,
yeah,
to the clave, and you can play it as a mambo or a cha-cha-cha. And Cal really had a really good knack for that, and I learned a great deal just by watching the way he
tunes
and did the same thing. You know?
Boncho, thank you so much for joining us again. It's Boncho Sanchez. We got Listen Here Cold Duck Time from the 1999 album Latin Soul, which won Best Latin Jazz Album at the 2000 Grammys. The Sunday lineup of the Hollywood Bowl Jazz Festival includes the great local aggregation The West Coast Get Down with special guests Leon Bridges and Rafael Sadiq. Let Us See, she's a wonderful singer performing Diggable Planets back together. The Soul Rebels also on that bill. Tickets available at laphil.org. Boncho Sanchez, thanks so much for joining us on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you very much.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Legislators in Sacramento are considering an exemption for motorcycle riders who wear religious or cultural headdresses, such as a turban or patka, from having to wear a helmet when riding a motorcycle. The bill has cleared the California State Senate. It was introduced by Republican State Senator Brian Dahl of the greater Sacramento and northern counties. You might recall that Senator Dolly was candidate for governor, joined us on Air Talk during his candidacy. Senator, it's good to have you back with us to talk about this bill. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Larry. Appreciate your time.
So there are more than 200,000 Sikhs who live here in California. That's close to half, according to U.S. Census data, of the nation's entire Sikh community. And share with us why you've introduced this bill to exempt members of that community and others that wear religiously dictated headdresses.
Well, during the governor's campaign, I went to a huge rally in Yuba City, actually, which is up north, just north of Sacramento. And there was a big group of folks who ride motorcycles from the Sikh community. And they mentioned to me that, they can't legally have their religious freedom and wear their turbans or patkas. So I mentioned to them I would attempt to run a bill. And so we did. They sponsored it, and I got it through the Transportation Commission, and then off of the Senate floor with 21 votes. We still have some work to do. It's been very tight. We only got the exact votes we needed to get it out. But the goal of the bill is to obviously make sure that they have the ability to have their customs and their religious freedom here in California. and other states don't have helmet laws. They do have the exemption for in the military. They can wear their turbans and they don't have to uncover when they in the military. And there's in Canada also in provinces they are able to wear their turbans and not have a helmet. And there's not a helmet that's available that goes over the turban. So that's where we're at with the bill at this point. We're in the assembly. We'll be looking at it in the transportation committee.
All right. The County Health Executives Association of California opposes the bill that Senator Dahle introduced. And in a statement, the Automobile Club of Southern California said the auto club supports helmet laws because they save lives and reduce serious injuries in traffic crashes involving motorcycles. Everyone has a right to self-expression, including while riding a motorcycle or any other form of transportation. But keeping riders safe should always remain a priority, and the Auto Club has come out in opposition to the legislation. You know, what's your response to those who say we certainly don't want to be disrespectful of Sikhs wearing of a turban, but the risk is just too high of riding a motorcycle without a helmet?
Well, you should know that statistically, head injury is one of the things that happen in motorcycle accidents, but many other injuries happen as well that because you're not surrounded by metal like we are in a car. So, you know, there is head injury, but the turban does somewhat protect the head as well. And so, but it's about, you know, taking a personal choice. You're an adult. You have to have a special license to ride a motorcycle. So you, at that point in your life, can make a decision whether you want to, you know, obviously have your constitutional right to have religious freedom and the freedom to be able to ride a motorcycle in California. So that's where we land on it. We are looking at some other opportunities, maybe of some material that they could be able to, but it's not developed yet, to be able to use that as their turban, which is even, they call it a tough turban, but it's not DOT approved and it's not available at this time. So we land on the side of personal freedoms, constitutional freedoms, and the ability to make a choice and not have such a nanny state. And when you look at the statistics again, a lot of the injuries are non-head injuries that cause fatalities in motorcycle accidents.
We're talking with Brian Dahle, California State Senator. The Republican represents portions of Sacramento, Shasta, Alpine, El Dorado, and Placer County. If you'd like to weigh in on this and whether you think there should be an exemption for those of the Sikh faith to be able to wear turbans in lieu of a motorcycle helmet, because their faith does require that men wear the turban, give us a call. We're at 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and your first name. John in Fullerton emailed, "I think this will be unenforceable. It could be a tactic," John writes, "to circumvent helmet laws." Well, that would certainly be going out of one's way to avoid wearing a helmet to wear a very religiously specific turban. But Senator Dahle, your response to that?
Well, we are looking at the ability when they get their license as a motorcycle license to be able to put on the license just like we do with an organ donor, saying, "Hey, I'm of the Sikh faith," and that would be something that would identify them as when they got their license that they would want to practice their faith. So, look, there's probably right now I have the largest population of Sikhs in America in my district, and so. When I talked to them, they said, you know, we ride our motorcycles with our turbans, and typically they've been getting warnings and not very few tickets. So at the end of the day, I think that folks realize that they want to be conscious of, law enforcement wants to be conscious of the fact that they are practicing their faith and they're not just trying to skirt the law. In the testimony at the committee, you know, they basically said we would rather die than take off our turban. And that's how strong we feel about our faith. So that's kind of the middle of the road where we're at with this bill. look, we don't want people, we want people to be safe, but we also want people to have their constitutional freedoms at the same time.
My understanding is that in the Sikh faith, the reason for wearing the turban is as a show of humility. Larian El Segundo said, does this bill guarantee that motorcycle insurance would increase as a result because and that it would be paid essentially by those wearing turbans as opposed to the general population? Has insurance at all been broached in this bill, Senator?
No, we have not had any testimony or anybody talk to us about insurance. Obviously, we have a ways to go before we get through the next committee. I think we'll be talking about those issues. We'll also be talking about the ability for them to be able to, you know, identify with their faith. And then and at that point, they would the insurance companies would know they're not, you know, going to be wearing a helmet. And then they could adjust that for that risk.
Michael in Santa Monica says, I'm a physician. I'm all for religious freedom, except when it impacts others. For motorcyclists to not wear helmets with the medical system, medical insurance, it affects others. Those who don't wear helmets accept the risks, but it affects other people. Michael, thank you for that. Senator Dolly, thank you very much. Good to have you with us again on Air Talk. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Republican California Senator Brian Dolly joining us on Air Talk. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, who writes on film for The New York Times and hosts the podcast Unspooled. Manuel Betancourt is contributing editor at Film Quarterly, and Charles Solomon, who writes on animation for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Transformers Rise of the Beasts, directed by Stephen Caple Jr. Amy, what did you think of the latest Transformers film?
Well, we all know Optimus Prime, and now, seven films into the franchise, we get to meet Optimus Primal. He is a biomechanical gorilla. He's here with some of his maximal friends. That's what they call this breed of Transformer. There's a robot cheetah, a robot falcon, a robot rhino. They're all here, and they're here doing just the same old nonsense. Oh no, get the thing, do the thing, the world's gonna destroy us. Blah, 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 blah. You know how these go. I will say, as a Transformers movie goes, this one, because Stephen Caple Jr. is the director of this, has a different flavor than the previous ones up until Bumblebee. This is a prequel. It's set in 1994, so it's in between Bumblebee and the Shia LaBeouf years. And it's set in Brooklyn, where you have, like, two actors I really like a lot, Anthony Ramos and Dominique Fishback. They're playing these, like, Brooklyn kids. She's a museum curator. He's an ex-vet who works with, you know, soldering irons or tries to find jobs, trying to do anything. And even though it's really leaning into that kind of 90s nostalgia that's everywhere, I really liked it. You got lots of hip-hop going on the soundtrack. You got every visual cue you can that's like Super Mario Brothers. You know that you're in the 90s. And that all works as well as it can until then the plot kicks in and everything's just as boring as ever and all the robots are fighting under gray skies on gray backdrops and you're like, what am I doing here? So as a Transformers movie goes, it's a little weird. The plot's a little bust. I believe very strongly that in a prequel you cannot be threatening us with the end of the world. We're all like, that's not going to happen. What are you doing? So there's plenty of time just to be like checking out, enjoying the sound design, which I've always loved in a Transformers film. I think the sound design is always incredible. I don't begrudge it a single Oscar nomination. In fact, I kind of wish it would win an Oscar nomination for sound at one point. And you get to just think, why does a robot gorilla have fur around its pecs? Is that a floor mat? What is that?
Transformers Rise of the Beasts, Manuel.
Amy, you forgot to tell us that they go to Peru and that they like they move from Brooklyn to Peru, which is kind of jarring and also kind of indicative of the sort of like wild swings that the movie takes. I think, you know, Anthony Ramos and Dominique Fishback are fantastic actors, and I was sort of a little sad that they get to be just, they're either scared or in awe. And then they're scared and then in awe. And those are the only two sort of notes that they're called to play. And they're such magnetic, charismatic performers that I almost wish we got to choose them a little bit more. But yeah, I found that, you know, if you love a Transformers film, this is you're going to enjoy this Transformers film. It has all the things that a Transformer film needs and has all these like action sequences. And especially at the end, it does get a little bit muddy and a little bit gray and a little bit like it's just clashing metal. And it's hard to sort of keep track. And the other thing that I will say that I did enjoy and that I think it's something that this one has that it's new is we got a lot of like really great voice work from people like Michelle Yeoh. We have Pete Davidson,
Peter Dinklage.
Yeah, and so in that sense, that's enjoyable and being like, okay, these actors that I love are getting some work. Yeah. But overall, I'm not a big fan of the franchise, but I was entertained for the most part.
That's Pete Davidson does get that one really good joke where Anthony Ramos is explaining, I have to go away with my work friends to save the world. And Pete Davidson goes, work friends, you've been inside me.
Transformers Rise of the Beasts is in wide release, rated PG-13, the seventh installment in the film series. Flamin' Hot is based on the story of Richard Montañez, who was a Frito-Lay janitor, who then, the story goes, and there's a lot of dispute over this, that he originated Flamin' Hot Cheetos, which became a food sensation. Eva Longoria makes her feature directorial debut. The screenplay is written by Lewis Kolick and Linda Yvette Chavez. Manuel, what did you think of Flamin' Hot?
I think this is a thoroughly enjoyable biopic of sorts. I think Longoria, who we all know from Desperate Housewives, I think this is an assured and solid debut for her as a filmmaker. It made me eager to see what she's going to do next. I will say this is very much a boilerplate kind of rags to riches or sort of like feels to exec rooms kind of story where we follow Richard as he's, you know, struggling to get out of a kind of life of crime and a life of gang life in this sort of world that in family that he's been born into, and he wants to do more and he wants to sort of like really make good on his kids, make good on his wife. And so he's very entrepreneurial. And so we follow him in the film as he's trying to sort of figure out, you know, how do these machines work? How are you engineering this? How do you make Cheetos? How do you make Doritos? To the exasperation of all of his coworkers who are like, what are you doing? We just clean the floors, just mop the floors. But so in a way, as a Chicano story and as a story of grit and a sort of this sort of American fairy tale dream, it's giving you all the beats that you need. I didn't see it with a crowd, but I imagine it's sort of a crowd pleaser. It moves really fast. It has a great rhythm. Jesse Garcia's Montañez, I think, he's charismatic, and you really want to see him succeed.
As Montañez himself apparently is as well.
Yes, yes.
So you need a charismatic actor to play a charismatic person. What do you think of Flamin' Hot, Amy?
Yeah, I can really see why Eva Longoria wanted to direct Montañez's story. And I do feel for her that it was only after she optioned it that pieces came out. They're like, I don't know if he's exactly being straight. Frito-Lay has denied a lot of this in here. But I think in order to counterbalance the shaky bits of the story, which she does to sort of say as he said them, she builds the story outward. It becomes, I think, a really kind of skeptical, sturdy look at the American dream. She works in Reaganomics. She works in the politics of the Chicano movement. And I think unlike the other movies that we've had right now, like Air and Blackberry, they're looking at corporate stories. She, I think, really acknowledges that the corporate world is not set up for everyone to succeed equally. And so I think the cynicism in this makes the story even more aspirational in a way, because you see somebody working even harder against a world that's not set up for him. And watching this now, you know, in 2023, it made it more painful for me to acknowledge that it's kind of worse now. Even today, a janitor working at Frito-Lay is probably outsourced through a third-party company and doesn't even get to stay around the machines and understand the system and work their way up. And also, I can understand, though, why they'd want to put the focus on a hot Cheeto, even if it's not true. I mean, hot Cheetos, they're not lacking in acclaim. I was just at the LA County Fair a couple of weeks ago. I eat hot Cheetos on pot stickers. They're just everywhere. Oh, so it's a sticky story that turns into at least a good crowd pleaser.
We're talking about Flamin' Hot, starring Jesse Garcia, directed by Eva Longoria. It's rated PG-13, and it's streaming on both Hulu and its sister platform, Disney+. Heroes of the Golden Masks is a U.S.-China co-production, an animated comedy adventure. Sean Patrick O'Reilly is the director and co-screenwriter. Charles, what did you think?
Well, usually you expect a comedy adventure to be funny and exciting. And
yeah, that seems basic.
Yeah, this isn't either, really. It's a lot of elements from Aladdin and the Kung Fu Panda movies recycled, not terribly effectively. The premise is there's this city in the past that's sort of more or less Chinese, that's defended by these noble warriors who put on masks and get superpowers. One of them dies nobly fighting the nasty villain voiced by Ron Perlman. The mask will take them to the next inheritor, who is a contemporary kid who's an orphan living on the streets of Chicago, a very underpopulated Chicago, rather than do a lot of, you know, crowd scenes, who's a street rat, and you see him picking pockets and stealing, except that's the opening of Aladdin, but Aladdin, they're very careful to make him sympathetic, and this kid is not. He's also tens of thousands of dollars in debt somehow to the mob, which is headed by one Rizzoli, voiced by Christopher Plummer, doing an Italian accent, which is probably the most humiliating final role for an actor since Orson Welles was in the GoBots movie decades ago.
You had to bring that up.
Yeah, I had to sit through it. So you have this, of course, ultimately the street rat turns into the good guy. He lives up to be a hero. They talk your ears off through the entire movie with the kind of dialogue of, I have a plan. Do you want to know what my plan is? I'll tell you what my plan is. By which point you're not interested in the plan. So, no.
All right. Heroes of the Golden Mass. It's based on John Wilson's 2018 young adult novel. Sean Patrick O'Reilly directed it. It was co-written by O'Reilly with a number of other writers. The film is on screen at Lemley's NoHo 7 in North Hollywood. It's also available on demand for home viewing. When we continue, we'll find out about the war drama Persian Lessons, The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster, which is a horror fantasy film, and Dali Land, set back in New York City in the early 1970s with an aging Salvador Dali at the center of that film. You're listening to Film Week on LAist 89.3. More to come in just a moment.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle joined by critics Charles Solomon, Manuel Betancourt, and Amy Nicholson. Next up is Persian Lessons, which is a war drama. It stars Nishul Perez Biscayart. The film is directed by Vadim Perlman. Manuel, what did you think of Persian Lessons?
I'm mixed on this because I ended up finding it a lot more engaging than I thought I would. It has a fantastic ending. Like, the final, it has a gut punch of an ending, which I think made me rethink the movie a little bit. But this is very maudlin. It sort of follows this young Jewish man who's about to be shot. And in a sort of a moment of sort of chance, he leads his Nazi, the Nazi soldiers who are going to shoot him, to think that he's Persian. And they're looking for a Persian guy because their commander wants to learn Farsi. And so, but they think he's lying, and they're like, of course, we'll take you to the commander, and then we'll be in his good graces, because we'll either have found you someone who can teach you Farsi, or we'll have found some Jew that we can then shoot for sport. He ends up figuring out a way to keep the ruse going for a long, long time, for months and months on end, at this concentration camp, and finding himself favored by the commander, and they sort of build this rapport. It's a little maudlin overall. It's a little sentimental. I think it sort of works through a lot of well-worn tropes and a lot of well-worn sort of ideas about what we think of a Holocaust film. You know, this idea of like imbuing these victims with a humanity that I think a lot of us can already sort of agree on. I think the thing that really sells it or sold it for me is the central performance by Nahuel Perez Biscayart, who is... I'm going to sound like a broken record today. Like, he is, he commands the screen. Like, he has such an expressive face. And so even when he's trying to figure out how to con this commander into thinking that he's actually teaching him Farsi when he knows one word in Farsi, is kind of exciting. And sort of you're constantly drawn in by his expressive eyes, by his physicality. Ultimately, I think you eventually sort of figure out like where the story is going. And it does have one final sort of gut punch of an ending. I don't know if that was... holy soul on it as a whole.
Persian Lessons, Amy.
Yeah, I was thinking as I started this film,
what are we going to do to make another concentration camp movie come in and have an emotional heft and a new dimension? Because we have so many strong ones already that have been made. And this one, yeah, it took a little bit to worm its way into me. And once it did, I was actually very happy that it did. This whole element of this young man trying to pretend that he is somebody named Reza and inventing a language on the fly, knowing that his life and death depends on it. This idea of just like every precious minute is just another minute that you're alive. You're stalling for time. And it's structured in a way that becomes very tense. Every day he has to figure out how to teach this guy new words that he's got to create from somewhere. And it's an interesting tone in this film. You know, the director kind of, he's willing to reveal that this commandant, who's played by Lars Eidinger, has his own human layers. And the human layers he reveals in this commandant almost sap a lot of the power from the Nazi party in this film in a way that I found really valuable to see. You know, there's bits of it where the tone almost feels like it could be a comedy if it wasn't so solemnly shot with dark shadows. And these minions that Manuel was referring to, who really want to figure out how to reveal Reza's scheme, they're almost structured like the villains in a high school comedy or like a workplace comedy. There's love triangles and they're always sniping at each other. And by making them seem so petty, the film does really great work to sap a lot of authority from these characters. And I found the questions it was raising actually really interesting. You have to do a lot of the thinking yourself to kind of pull out the director because he doesn't want to explain everything to you. But it's, you know, about the perceived value of a human life, about the inability to communicate in these extraordinary ways. It's really a fight about who defines words and reality and the power of gossip and language. I found myself at times being like, I wish I knew something about this character before he showed up here. The film really only takes place in this world. You know nothing about him other than his mechanics to survive. But yet, at the end, I was like, good, you have found a new way into this story, and I really appreciate having seen this one.
Persian Lessons is the film starring Nahuel Perez Biscayar. The film is directed by Vadim Perlman. Ilja Zofin is the screenwriter. The movie's unrated and it's multilingual in German, Farsi, and French with English subtitles. Persian Lessons is showing at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster is a horror fantasy starring Lea De Leon Hayes. It's written and directed by Bomani J. Story. Amy, what did you think?
Yeah, this is a modern Frankenstein story where the evil doctor is actually just a teenage girl in a rough neighborhood trying her best. She's seen a lot of violence. She's lost her mom to violence. She's lost her brother to violence. This violence is now throwing her dad kind of off the rails, and she's thinking, her theory is death is a disease and I must cure it. She's a high school girl, very smart in the sciences, builds a lab and tries to figure out if she can bring people back to life. This first part of the story is actually really great. The actress Lea De Leon Hayes is playing the girl, Vicaria, and her character is funny, stubborn, prickly. She's not trying to be liked that much by everybody, you know, and she becomes a really credible mad scientist in a story where you are buying that there's a laboratory in this crowded neighborhood that nobody is discovering. I think this is a really promising debut. Like, the way that it's shot is great. The camera work is very smart. It uses special effects sparingly, but in that old school way where you're like, oh, blue lightning, that 80s style blue lightning. There is a monster, of course. There's no monster POV, so it doesn't take that tick of a Frankenstein story, but it makes you use your imagination to see how it was designed. Because it is so good, I got very disappointed when it loses a lot of steam at the end and just becomes, you know, chase, 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 scream, scream, scream. It ends very strong in the last minute, though, so I'll give it that.
The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster is unrated. It's in select theaters and available later this month on demand for home viewing. Dali Land is based on an event that actually happened in the life of Salvador Dali back in 1973. It stars Ben Kingsley and Barbara Sukowa. Mary Herron is the director. John Walsh wrote the screenplay. Manuel, you please start us on Dali Land.
Sure. Right, so we're transported back to 1973 when Dali is tasked with putting up a gallery showing, and he's a little distracted by young and beautiful women and young and beautiful men and the life in New York. And his wife, Gala, just really wants him to sit down and actually paint something because they need the money. And so this young assistant is tasked with getting him to work. Which, of course, is a Herculean task that he sort of struggles with. So we're getting this sort of late in life Dali, and he's sort of struggling with what it means. What kind of ambition, artistic ambition, does he have right now? Where does he fit into the art world in the 1970s? I found myself a little I will say bored. This is kind of, I found it a very listless film. When you have a character like Salvador Dali, and a title like Dalila, and I'm expecting a lot, and instead,
yeah, visually it's sort of, you're visually expecting a lot, too.
And instead it's so flat. It's very mundane looking. We have a lot of like medium shots. This person speaks. This other person speaks. I didn't find that the film had a grasp on the kind of commentary it wanted to make on Dali the artist, Dali the man, Dali the womanizer, Dali the crazed genius who may be spying on you when you're having sex with someone at a party. It's really unerotic, despite how much it focuses on sex and sort of these relationships. I found that Kingsley and Sokoa are trying their best, but I don't know, these outside personalities are sort of hard to capture, and there's just no POV for them to sort of find their ground.
Great actors, too. Yeah. It's unfortunate. We're talking about Dali Land, Amy.
Yeah, the best part about it is just sort of stepping back from this movie and thinking, it is true that we go on this arc with geniuses where there's sometimes a stretch before they die where we say, oh, they're not geniuses anymore. And then we reanoint them geniuses after their death. So this is in that period of Dali's life where everybody's kind of finding his shtick exhausting. And there's this kind of interplay where Dali's wandering around by Ben Kingsley's Dali just saying things like, I'm going to build the largest physical male member in the world. And everybody's like nodding with reverence. And you're like, are they being serious right now? Is he being serious right now? And this idea of who we treat as though they're intellectual gods and sucking up to them and nodding along to them and kind of buying into their shtick is interesting, because it happens in these rooms where there's parties and champagne, and then it does not happen very much in the rest of the world where serious people get to examine them. So I liked all that, this idea of a codependent relationship between Dali and Gala that's really run its course, and yet you don't know where anybody can go from here. Again, yeah, I agree. Like, you're expecting more visual wow and wonder than this has. Instead, it does something really curious. You get these flashback scenes to young Dali, you know, where he's played by the actor Ezra Miller. And these scenes, I think, are supposed to translate a time when, like, him and his relationship with Gala was fresh. But instead, they're just done with this candlelit staginess, like physical memories where older Dali is able to walk through them. And it just feels dull. You don't feel this idea of an arc of life that went from possibilities to stale.
Well, and it's too bad, because I remember in that era, and I was really young, but he would come on talk shows, and Dali, the film opens
with one of those game show appearances. Okay. And is literally the
what's
best
my
part.
Line?
Yeah. Yeah, what's my line?
He was also in Dick Cavett, along with Lillian Gish, and brought an anteater with him.
So he was like, you know, even if he wasn't painting that much then, he was such an engaging personality. It's unfortunate the film either can't do visually, like you were talking about, Manuel, or doesn't give you sort of the dynamism of who he was as a person, along with all the baggage you brought up as well. That could have made a really great film.
Yeah, the one scene that I think actually really does work is you see a moment where Dali and Gala are preparing for a party, and you watch them make themselves up in the mirror, turn themselves into these caricatures that they feel like they need to do to perform.
Oh, that's cool.
That's really cool. That scene is great.
Yeah, we're talking about Dali Land. Mary Herron, the director, John Walsh, the screenwriter. It's based on this period of Salvador Dali's life, 1973. Ben Kingsley, Barbara Sukova star in the film, which is unrated. And it's at the Landmark New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. Coming up, the stand-up comedy on Netflix of Amy Schumer, Emergency Contact. We'll also find out about the historical drama horror film Brooklyn 45. It's Film Week on LA's 89.3. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle joined by critics Manuel Betancourt, Amy Nicholson, and Charles Solomon. Up next is the Netflix streaming stand-up comedy special, Amy Schumer, Emergency Contact, and Schumer directed herself in the comedy special. Manuel.
Yeah, so this is Amy Schumer, who people will remember from her previous specials and from Inside Amy Schumer, the Peabody Award-winning comedy sketch show that she used to have. Right here, she's beginning with, you know, she's now a mom, she's now married, she's entered her 40s, she won't wear heels, her body is changing, and a lot of the humor really comes from sort of this changing world, and like, now she can't be a party girl, or maybe she's still a party girl, but now her body sort of won't let her be be as much of a party girl as she used to. And sort of this clashing of her youthful energy and her irreverence, sort of coming to terms with a body and a life that won't really allow her to do that, is where a lot of the comedy comes from. If you're a fan of Schumer, this hits all the sweet spots. It's really enjoyable. She has a killer Alec Baldwin joke, pun intended, and a lot of great sort of like observational moments about sort of what it means to be a sort of an aging or geriatric millennial right now. So you'll find, you know, jokes about melatonin and Ozempic and fillers. And if that is the kind of humor that you gravitate towards, she is going to deliver. She is really well assured on stage. Like, she's one of those comedians that, you know, you're in great hands. And she really does have a flair for sort of how to deliver the jokes and then find how to capture them on camera. Like, it's really dynamic. You don't really feel like she just like packed it. In fact, she constantly is directing. She's like, I want this. Let me get me in profile.
Oh,
show my nose now. So I want to get my legs. And did you catch that? And she's talking directly at the cameraman, which I found like added a sense that we were actually there, even if we weren't in the audience.
We're talking about Amy Schumer, Emergency Contact, her latest stand-up comedy, streaming on Netflix starting next Tuesday. It's unrated, but for adults, we can be assured. Brooklyn 45, a horror film with a historical theme, and Ramsey Ron E. Raines star in it. Ted Gagan is the writer-director. Amy, what do you think of Brooklyn 45?
I like the script of Brooklyn 45 a lot. In execution, it's a little stagey, but it is this one-room horror drama with this ensemble of people who are playing veterans from World War II, right when the war has ended. They're all a little older and grizzled. They're like colonels and majors and such like that. And they meet at a lieutenant colonel's brownstone. He's played by Larry Fessenden. A few months after the war ended, the lieutenant colonel's in a bad way. His wife has died by suicide. And he's like, let's do a seance. I need to know if she's in a better place. And these are all characters who have seen death and pain, you know, and they're not from a generation who's really able to talk about it. And he really convinces them to do it. And then, of course, brutal things start to happen and everybody starts screaming at each other. And I don't really even want to hint about what comes next, because I found this to have really good veers that I respected a lot, you know, as they reveal things from the war, throw things from the war at each other. And it's also a very willing to get gnarly at the end with some gore. But, you know, performance-wise, it is just sort of a little bright, a little cartoonish. I feel like I would love to see this at a theater. I would love to sit in a dark room and watch this unfold in front of me there.
That, at least right now, is not an option. Brooklyn 45 is streaming on two services, Shudder, which is dedicated to horror, of course, and AMC Plus. Written and directed by Ted Gagan, it's unrated. The documentary Americond is directed by Sean Claffey. Charles?
I found this a very frustrating film because I agreed with pretty much everything it was saying, but it didn't say it terribly well. It's about how the middle class has basically been shafted over the last couple of decades and is diminishing and diminishing. But it lacks a focus and a structure. You start out with a very charismatic black man who's trying to organize Amazon warehouse workers. But then it's about homelessness. Then it's about the price of cost of rent. Then it's about independent contractors. Then it's about the Koch brothers. Then it's about the Federalist Society. Then it's about court decisions. Then it's about, again, if this material had been better organized or better focused, I think they could have made their point more effectively. And they don't deal with, in the sections they talk about politics, well, how did Republicans get people to vote against their own economic interests that made so much of the situation they're describing possible? So well-intentioned, good ideas, some good footage, but it just doesn't come together as a film.
Americond, Sean Claffey, the director. It's unrated. It's at the Lemley Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Lynch / Oz is a documentary that looks at the Wizard of Oz and its influence on David Lynch. The film is directed by Alexander O. Philippe Manuel.
I think documentary is a little bit of a misnomer because I think it's a series of video essays that are sort of brought together under this rubric of understanding the well-documented obsession that David Lynch, the director of Twin Peaks and Wild at Heart and Mulholland Drive, has with Victor Fleming's 1939 classic, including one by our very own Amy Nicholson.
Oh, hi. Yeah.
But also you have, you know, segments voiced and narrated by John Waters and Karen Kusama. And those are the ones that I really found really fascinating because they're trying to sort of tease out, you know, what does it mean to think of this Lynchian world to have been born out of an obsession with Dorothy and the Wicked Witch of the West and Kansas and going back home. And one of the things that the film does is uses a lot of visual juxtaposition, showing like, look, there's this moment from Twin Peaks that's exactly like Dorothy. There's this moment like Wild at Heart that's like this. And over and over and over again, to the point where it ends up being a little bit repetitive. Stylistically, if we're not seeing the same images, but we're seeing the same kind of juxtaposition. And so I think Lynch fans and Wizard of Oz fans and cinephiles will find a lot to really enjoy. There are some really fascinating discussions about, you know, what John Waters himself has taken from The Wizard of Oz. When you think, you know, nothing in Waters' filmography would really think make you think that,
I
like,
don't
Dorothy.
Know, Divine Dorothy, maybe.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. And I think it's the same thing with Lynch. It feels so such an odd piece, and yet as soon as you start teasing it apart, it's there everywhere. And this is the thing that the documentary sort of does really well. So there are a lot of moments that are really gratifying, and sort of as a student of film, I was really engaged to see and happy to see. But in others, I found myself sort of a little bit bored and wanted a little bit more.
Amy, you have any share about being part of this film?
She was the Glenda the Good.
Well, I have the opening segment where I talk a lot about The Wizard of Oz in particular and its place in America and its place, you know, I would think for like young Lynch, I get to pull back the curtain on that, to use a metaphor that both of them use visually. I feel like I can't review this one, but I can at least say that I will be at Vidiots with Alexander, with Karin, with Rodney Asher, doing a Q&A on Sunday at 4 o'clock. We're going to show
the new Vidiots in Eagle Rock.
New Vidiots. Hey. It's all very exciting. Oh, everybody go to the new
Vidiots. Yeah, on Eagle Rock Boulevard. Yeah, so that's terrific. Lynch/Oz is the film. It's directed by Alexander O. Philippe and unrated. The Secret Kingdom is a family adventure starring Sam Everingham and Alila Brown. It's written and directed by Matt Drummond. Manuel, we have only a minute, but a quick review of this.
Only a minute. We began with a movie that had really impressive, but also kind of muddy CGI, and we end with a film that has kind of muddy and horrible CGI, which is about these two siblings who find that there is a secret kingdom underneath their house, their bed, and there are pangolins and double-headed turtles and lots of riddles to be solved so that an unnamed villain may not... You sort of get the gist of it.
Yeah.
They learn a lot about themselves. There's a kind of a twist at the end, which obviously I won't spoil. As a kid's adventure film, I don't know what kind of kid would sit through this. But I also don't spend a lot of time with kids, so maybe they will. But I found it rather boring and really not particularly exciting to look at.
The Secret Kingdom, Matt Drummond, the writer-director. It's Australian and rated PG at Lendlease Glendale Theater in Glendale. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. We're going to be continuing momentarily. You're listening to Film Week on LAist 89.3.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.